This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast, and here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm Ed McGrogan, talking with Pete Bodo. Pete, this is the first time I've actually had you on the podcast since Wimbledon ended. You were there for all 2 weeks, and it's a tournament that obviously always connects with tennis fans probably most of all. Even a week outside of Wimbledon now, I think people still kind of have the tournament fresh in their minds. So much happened. You had two of the 30-year-old players, two all-time greats winning the tournament. You had Nadal losing second round. You had Djokovic seeding the number one ranking despite, a year's worth of almost just incredible results there. So really, you know, stepping away from it now for a week, kind of what's your real big takeaway from that tournament as a whole, thinking about it?
Well, the big takeaway is that, you know, there's no big takeaway. That's the thing. I mean, a wonderful thing is this was one of the most kaleidoscopic tournaments I've seen in a long time, and it was a wonderful tournament from beginning to end, just full of surprises and crazy twists and turns. I mean, everything from the golden set turned in by Yaroslava Shvedova to, you know, Johnny Murray, the doubles champion, the first British male doubles champion, in Wimbledon for since 1936. So, you know, it was just everywhere you turn, there was something new. You know, needless to say, the upset of Rafa, you know, the play of Roger, the fact that Murray gets to the final as an Englishman, you know, those are all, you know, I mean, everything came together. It really was, you know, I mean, the most impressive thing, I suppose, about it in a big picture was that you had two 30-year-olds, all-time greats, both coming through and winning. I think the fact that both of them did it made that kind of special.
Yeah, both of them, Federer and Serena Williams, are both in the news this week, actually, besides really their titles, even though the title is the reason that Federer is in the news again. It's winning Wimbledon got him the number one ranking and broke a long-standing and long-discussed tie atop the most weeks at number one with Pete Sampras, who Federer obviously grew up watching. You know Pete, of course. You wrote his biography with him. You know, for that achievement there, that was one that was always mentioned as something that Federer never really could realistically achieve after we saw what happened with Nadal and Djokovic and them winning all the winning, you know, getting to all the slam finals. But here we are right now with Federer back at number one, and almost it feels a little bit almost like 2009 again. It feels like a reset button really has been put on the whole men's circuit in a good way, I think.
Well, yeah, except you got to wonder how long it can possibly last. I mean, I'd be the last one to rain on Roger's parade. But, you know, I mean, this was just a wonderful, wonderful statement. If you had to write a narrative where, you know, a kind of a dream story, an inspirational story for kids to watch or something, you couldn't come up with a better plot line than the one Roger worked this time around. The only thing he could possibly have done was made him 40 years old and coming out of retirement to do this, become number one, take Beach record, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there was just, you know, it was just a magnificent moment. I think it's going to be hard for Roger to sustain that level. I don't know whether he can, whether he even needs to, really. I mean, this was the moment that was waiting to happen in his career. Most big players make a big statement before the very end. Connors had that run at the U.S. Open in, 1991 or something. Of course, he was in his 40s, early 40s, I think, at the time. But, you know, he did not win the tournament. Pete Sampras did win the tournament after two terrible years, one horrible year when he was, you know, ready to pack it in, basically, but he just always knew there was something still left in the tank. And now Roger joins that elite group of people who at age 30, could still come through and make a big statement, and you couldn't have crafted a better storyline.
And then Serena, like we're saying, also in the news this week, she ended up playing, winning Stanford, but besides that, on its own, Stanford wasn't a great field, but the fact that Serena is even playing tennis the week after a Grand Slam title, you know, regardless of winning a slam, this is someone who I feel like as recently as a year or two ago was almost invisible outside of the slams. And lately, especially this year, she has won many titles. I think have propelled her to that Wimbledon success, you know, on the tour level. And what we see from Serena now is you look at her record and it's I believe a 38-3 mark through 2012, sort of under the radar, I suppose, if it can be said that for Serena, and just, you know, continuing to kind of defy really convention as she's done, I think, throughout most of her career.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, under the radar is a little bit too strong a term here, because Serena's never under the – Serena would be over the – on the radar even if she walked down to the 7-Eleven to get a giant Slurpee. So, I mean, you know, let's face it. She's, you know, she's whatever she makes a move or whenever she appears at a tournament, she's going to get all kinds of eyeballs on her. But, you know, I think what this has shown really to me, a big part of this is that Serena, you know, whether she consciously sort of took this away from the past few months and years or not – is open to debate, I guess, but we'd have to ask her. But I think what she's finding out is that, boy, you can play a lot better when you play a lot. You know, she played from Charleston on. She really was pretty much a full-time player, even though she had some niggling problems here and there. And the record shows that she's won, I think, 28 of the past 29 she's won. And she's in the groove. She's winning. She's, you know, she's got that consistency again. I think one of the big things about Stanford was, and you're right, by the way, Eddie, I mean, you know, who would, you know, well, what was the last time a Grand Slam champion actually played the week after in a relatively small event? I mean, I was trying to think of it today, and I can't for the life of me remember. But, you know, she's learned a lesson. I think she's really trying to peak for the Olympics. I think the subtext there is, you know, if it wasn't an Olympic year, does she play Stanford? Well, maybe not. On the other hand, you know, being an Olympic year, she could have said to Stanford, you know, no thanks. I need a couple weeks recuperation time, get some time on grass. It raises an interesting issue that I think is true for both the men and the women. You know, these tournaments in the summer now between Wimbledon and now between the Olympics, but generally speaking between Wimbledon and the U.S. Open, have always been a good time for American players to collect some ranking points, get some of that prize money going, you get a little bit of their, you know, mojo back, you know, if they needed it because of, you know, the hard court circuit is, you know, it's kind of like the Europeans on clay in the spring. And they're still doing it. They're playing. I see this week we've got a bunch of American boys in the Atlanta tournament. Serena now is done, which I think is a good thing for her. But you got to wonder, you know, at what point does the grass court mentality kick back in, especially because before the Olympics, because it's going to be held in just about 2 weeks' time over in London at Wimbledon.
Yeah, you had to wonder if Newport would sort of benefit from that little scheduling quirk where it's going to go back to grass there. That's what I was kind of wondering about is – I think in your piece today, you're around the world. You really, I think, suggest that the weeks leading up to the Olympics take on a greater importance because of that. I was kind of juggling that in my head, whether to think, well, I'm not sure if it would be of players' best interest to kind of shut down for a couple weeks after Wimbledon. You do have sort of many players. I think almost all of them are flying, you know, those at least born in the States, they're flying back here, then they're making the flight back to Europe. I suppose, you know, tennis players are long used to such travel and everything, but I was kind of wondering really, you know, what the mentality of players is in this sort of irregularly scheduled season where we're going to turn right back around and go to an event that I think in many cases players are treating with as much, if not more, reverence than a Grand Slam title.
Well, that's the funny thing, you know, that's kind of true. But then if that reverence is there, you know, where are the people taking the time off to build up this event? Now, they've basically had their grass court tune-up. It's called Wimbledon, you know, funny as that sounds. And most of them played either Halle or Eastbourne or Nottingham or one of those tournaments anyway. So now basically they're dialed in on grass. Do you really now want to go to a hard court, change your game around a little bit, change your mentality around a little bit, deal with some of the heat and humidity issues that may come up, and play? Well, you know, granted, if you're going to play one tournament, maybe you get away with that. But I think that if you were really targeting Wimbledon, I almost think that unless you really needed matches really badly in terms of the competition, you'd almost be better off just taking the time off and, you know, and maintaining your grass court game, finding a nice place where you can go and hit balls on grass. The only other caveat there, by the way, is that I think the Wimbledon courts really are kind of special. I mean, they're really different from the Newport four courts. They're different from all the other grass courts. Grass courts tend to be a lot slicker and lower bouncing than the Wimbledon courts because of the big changes Wimbledon made to enhance the game and get more rallies going and stuff. So I don't know exactly, you know, how much you're giving up by practicing on a different grass court other than Wimbledon, which is really not the same thing as if, say, practicing on hard courts, different hard courts. They tend to be the same. So it's a tricky question, I think. But you know, I wonder, especially with how much these guys have gone through in the spring and summer, although I guess the Americans are an exception because they didn't do very well on a clay court circuit, it would be an ideal time really to rest up and just really get your head around teed up for the Olympics.
And one thing I'm thinking about here is, you know, we're the main players here, of course, on the men's side. That's the top four there. I think I do kind of agree with what you're saying earlier about Federer, that really I think Wimbledon was that statement where really the man has almost nothing to prove anymore. I don't think he did before Wimbledon, but, you know, with that 17th slam, 7th Wimbledon, I think, as it has been for most of his career, it's kind of gravy on top from here on out. But the other three, who are all coming off very different endings to their Wimbledon, Nadal, of course, going down the second round, and you see reports kind of that, of his knee injury resurfacing, whether he had to pull out an exhibition, for example. Not just any exhibition. This is a fairly important one against Djokovic in front of 80,000 people. So I think there's something to be said for that. And you have Djokovic, who in a turn of events from the French Open when he played Federer, he goes down, you know, fairly meekly at Wimbledon to Federer and loses the number one ranking. You kind of wonder maybe where he is at. He's not far behind Federer for number one, but it is an interesting statement. And then you have Murray, of course, who reached the final. You know, did Murray give everything he had at that tournament? He does get to go back and try it again, essentially, at you know, with different stakes, of course. So of those three men, I think maybe the question I have for you is which of those three really have the most to prove in this Olympic and this, you know, these upcoming summer weeks leading up into the U.S. Open?
Well, I think in a way it's Djokovic because, look, let's face it, Djokovic made his intentions pretty clear from the start of this year, saying his real priorities were the French Open and the Olympic Games. Now, we saw what happened at the French Open. He didn't win it. He lost in a final. You know, good effort to get to the final, but he missed that opportunity to complete a career Grand Slam and become the first man since Rod Laver in the late 1960s to have all four Grand Slam titles at the same time. So he's coming in now, you know, he loses at Wimbledon, so now he's coming in. He could really salvage, you know, his dreams for this season, really, by winning the Olympic gold medal. And when you factor in what a, you know, patriotic guy he is and how proud he is to be a Serb, and, you know, basically the fact that Serbia has never been a power in the Olympic Games, I think him winning a gold medal, you know, doing that would be a great coup for him and for his nation, and just, you know, continue to even further solidify, if it's possible, his reputation as a kind of a national treasure and an ambassador to the world at large. Nadal, I think, is in big trouble. I think, you know, some of my Spanish friends who are pretty close to his camp told me that his knee condition has now been I don't know if it's downgraded or upgraded from tendonitis to tendinopathy or something, which is a recurring condition of tendonitis. So it's a more serious level of risk with his tendonitis there than we've had in the past. So, you know, he apparently, you know, I think, you know, he's carrying a flag for Spain in the Olympics, and I think that's going to mean a great deal to him. I think he wouldn't skip it for that, but I wonder if he's realistically likes his own chances given the physical problems he's having and the fact that, after all, he still builds his year on a Grand Slams. The guy to watch is Roger, actually, because, look, I mean, one more thing. All right, Murray, you know, I don't know. It's hard to imagine him, after going through that emotional thing at Wimbledon, getting it back together for, you know, for the games. On the other hand, you know, it is, you know, I don't think the Wimbledon factor and the UK factor is going to mean that much, but it is best of three. And, you know, when he's on fire, he can do a lot of damage. I think Federer is kind of the interesting guy to watch because, you know, he's got so much confidence. He's so good on the grass. He's not hurt. He's not tired. He's not playing. Then again, I don't think any of those big four are. So, you know, between now and the Olympic Games. So, you know, we'll see what he does. But he's in a pretty good position just to go out there and just feel good and take big cuts and see what happens.
It's true. I mean, he is going to get, going in with as good of a run as any of those, and I'm sure he's going to be playing with Stan Wawrinka in doubles again, defending their gold medal. I there was long talk ago of him and Hingis playing mixed, but I know that's been put aside now. That's not going to happen. Summer of Roger, summer of George, anyone. So, it could happen here. So it's a time, and like we said, it's going to all filter back in toward the U.S. Open, of course. But it's a summer, I think, of opportunity for a lot of these guys. So, Pete, again, thank you. We'll catch up just before the Olympics, of course. I'm Emmerich Rogan. Thanks for listening. Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying Tennis.com's weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.